All right, welcome back to Nos Adietas, the Sounder at Heart podcast. I'm Jeremiah O'Shan. With me, as always, is Aaron Campo. We had a pretty amazing game this week. Probably the most enjoyable game in the most enjoyable game in Quest Field history, next to the opener against the Red Bulls in 2009. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. The U.S. Open Cup final was pretty fantastic.
That was enjoyable for a totally different reason, though. I think
that's true. Yeah.
Like that one was enjoyable because you actually won something. It wasn't so much. I mean, the game was fun, but it was much more tense. Like this was almost like it was like we scored early, we led throughout. We never really felt like the Sounders were going to give up the lead. You have that great moment with the Zach Iwani tribute. You have a penalty kick goal. It was just like one thing after another. I mean, it seemed like it was just one long celebration almost.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, actually. The only enjoyable part of the U.S. Open Cup final was when the whistle blew. The rest of it, I felt like I was going to throw up. And you're right, you know, this entire game was just fun. And it was, I think once that first goal went in and it was kind of like, all right, so, you know, we can actually survive without Zach Iwani and without O'Brien White. And, you know, we're going to be okay. Maybe not as dangerous, but we can still compete in this league. Because, you know, I don't think that that's a rational fear, but I think it's a fear that was in the back of a lot of people's minds. Like, you know, Zach Iwani is kind of a talisman, and now we've lost our starting striker as well, and Mauro Rosales isn't playing. And, you know, and then we come out very early, get a very good goal. And, you know, I think it kind of eased a lot of that pressure and took a lot of the tension out of the air. Zach Iwani tribute, I think, went off beautifully. And then, you know, get another goal right after the half, and just rolling from then on out. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the thing that probably made it a lot of fun was that it wasn't just a matter of the Sounders scoring goals. It was a matter of the way that they were scoring goals, and it was kind of an exciting attacking style. We didn't see the long ball used almost at all. We saw a lot of passes that were, you know, short, quick passes, balls on the ground. I mean, it was basically the kind of soccer that I think Seattle fans have been saying they want to see forever, essentially.
Yeah, it was definitely different than what I was expecting to see. And you know, I've been critical, I think, a lot here and to anyone that would listen about one of my biggest complaints with Siggy being a stubbornness to switch things up, and he switched things up a lot. And you know, I think that it was really an example of him looking at what he had at his disposal for that game and saying, you know, this is what is going to be the most effective. And you know, instead of going with the pure wide midfielders, he had Alvaro and Evans sort of more in attacking mid central left and central right attacking midfield roles. They weren't playing real deep. The width was coming from the fullbacks, and you know, they had the diamond in the center. It was fun to watch, and you know, that might not be the most effective style to play when you do have a healthy Zach Iwani or you do have a a healthy Mauro Rosales or a healthy O'Brien White. But for the collection of talent that was at his disposal, I think it was the best way to play and the best way to go after it. And it was a really impressive win, I think, on pretty much every front.
Yeah, exactly. And it was and I think that was what was so awesome about it was not just like one thing. It was like all these different things that made it a great game. And it was really nice to see the Sounders use players in a way that seemed like it was, you know, suiting their skills. You had Alvaro Fernandez playing on the left side, but playing more of a he was not playing a Steve Zach Iwani left mid. He was playing very much his own kind of mid, where you had Tyson Wall overlapping significantly, and sometimes to the point of Alvaro being almost behind the midfield line. And then on the right side, you had Brad Evans that was just, I mean, that's a Brad Evans I don't know that we've ever seen in terms of the skill that he showcased.
No, I don't think so. It came out of nowhere. And, you know, I think that one of the things that people have to be careful about it, as I've heard a lot in response to the game. Like, you know, that was impressive and it was good to see, but Toronto is not a good team, and we can't take too much away from this game. And I guess as a full team effort, that's reasonable. But Brad Evans was not impressive because Toronto was bad. Brad Evans was impressive because Brad Evans was really impressive. I mean, he was making just excellent runs all night. He was pretty much unbeatable, I think, in the air when he did have duels to deal with. He and Freeburg were doing a lot of switching of roles, which, you know, I thought was impressive. I thought the overall fluidity of the team and the ability to shift on the fly was quite impressive as well. You know, like you said, you had Wall pushing forward almost to the point where Alvaro was dropping back into a wingback role and attack a lot of the time, where he could kind of send in balls from outside of the box. And so you almost had a 3-5-2 in transition, or even a 3-6-1 on occasion. And, you know, it was something that I didn't really ever expect to see out of this team, especially with such key players missing. I think Brad Evans was a huge part of that. He's the kind of player that people refer to as an engine player, and, you know, a lot of that is due to his fitness and his ability to run, but he just did everything right in this game, and everything sort of hinged on him, and his ability to sort of put pressure on the back line wherever he was, and his ability to sort of seamlessly switch into defense so that, you know, anytime Toronto started to counter down that side, it just got shut down really quickly. I think Toronto had maybe one successful counterattack all night, and Tyson Wall ran pretty much from the edge of Toronto's box to catch up with I don't remember who it was, one of Toronto's three strikers, and knocked the ball out. So it was very attacking, but there was never really that sense that they were giving away a lot in transition. And it was impressive. It was incredibly impressive.
And speaking of the attack-minded nature of that team, I mean, you even saw John Kennedy Hurtado joining the attack, which I don't remember the last time we've seen that. You know, on the goal that Evans' first goal, you had, you know, it was an interesting play because you had Freddie Montero essentially lay the ball off, or send that he didn't lay it off. He sent it forward to Brad Evans, who was able to run onto it and score. But Freddie Montero essentially just stopped in his tracks and played back. And I think part of the reason he did that was because you had John Kennedy Hurtado just streaking down the middle of the field, ready for, you know, essentially to claim a rebound, and which never came, thankfully. But it was, you know, I just don't remember the last time we've seen John Kennedy Hurtado joining the attack to the level that he did. I mean, we've seen him come up on set pieces and things like that, which is not that strange at all. But to see him within the run of play, just, you know, getting up and pushing forward all the way into the opponent's box was kind of remarkable to see.
It really was, and I think that, you know, part of that is probably because I think Seattle was in such control of that game that, you know, I think that they were willing to do some experimentation, and I think it's worth maybe exploring a little further in other games, because I think it worked quite well. I also think that, you know, Siggy has to be aware of the mood around the team right now, and maybe he felt like getting an impressive win where the team was attacking and in control the whole time would maybe ease some concerns, because, you know, it can't just be the fans that are wondering how this team is going to fare going forward without some pretty crucial players. And as confident as I think the Sounders are, you know, they're also aware of how important Steve Zakimani and O'Brien White are to the team. So, you know, I think that's got to be a part of the equation, with Hurtado getting that involved in the attack and Wall getting that involved in the attack, and, you know, even Riley pushing up. There were really points in time where there were 9 outfield players taking an active role in the attack. I've never seen the Sounders do that unless they were having to chase a goal. Even against Philadelphia, where they got that last minute equalizer, they weren't being that aggressive. I mean, it was just flat out to the wall attacking. And but, you know, just to really quickly get back to that play with Evans, on the Evans run of play goal, that was one of the more impressive full team attacks that I've seen in a long time. The ball into Montero, I didn't see who supplied that, I still haven't had a chance to watch a full replay of the
game. I think
game.
It was actually Hurtado that supplied.
Was it Hurtado? Yeah. See, there you go. And
he won it around midfield.
Yeah, and so, you know, that was an impressive ball in. Montero did everything perfectly on that play where he sort of, you know, did the Trey Cartista thing where he stops, draws everyone into him, and just finds the run. I thought Evan's finish was remarkable. I mean, that's...
Absolutely clinical finish.
Absolutely. He's gotten a lot of stick for the one time he made a comical error in a friendly. And, you know, I mean, it was funny, and I don't mind jokes about it. But he's not a bad finisher, and I think that, you know, he ran onto it and I don't think took a touch. I think he just put it in
first time.
Yeah, right into the back corner. It was a fantastic finish. And, you know, like you said, Hurtado made that run in to try to claim the rebound. And I think Freddie was perfectly positioned where he was, right in the center in a lot of space. So if the rebound comes out long, if the keeper's off his line, he can either, you know, try to volley it back in or look to create again. So it was just smart. I mean, the Sounders just looked like they knew what they wanted to do all night long. And they were being maybe a little bit more aggressive. And so, you know, things didn't always necessarily click the way that they might have wanted them to. But they had a plan the whole night out, the whole night through. Everything seemed very clinical. And, you know, if that team can execute in that fashion consistently, I don't think that we're really in any danger of not being an elite team going into the playoffs.
No, and watching them, and obviously we realized that we were playing a pretty bad Toronto FC team. We were playing a Toronto FC team that has now lost three straight. They have, I think they're on either a 5 or 6 match winless streak. So they're certainly in a bad space right now. There's no question that things are not going well in Toronto. That said, these are professional soccer players. You know, these are sometimes, in some cases, they're professional soccer players that have played at very high levels in other parts of the world. So it's not like we're out there beating up on some rec team or, you know, a youth team or whatever. I mean, this is a legitimate team with legitimate coaches. And I don't think you can just write off almost any win in MLS. And you certainly can't write off a win when the team, the winning team looks as good. I mean, all 3-0 victories obviously are not created equal. But I think this is a 3-0 victory that is just an absolute domination.
It really was. And, you know, to get back to what you were saying about making Toronto look bad, you know, I mean, yeah, Toronto might be one of the worst teams in the league right now, but we've talked so many times about the parity in this league and about how the worst team in the league can beat the best team in the league. I mean, the Timbers beat Real Salt Lake. Not to say the Timbers are,
I mean, and to piggyback on that point, not to cut you off, but the reality is, I mean, not the reality is, that sounds ridiculous, but Toronto beat the Timbers 2-0 at home.
Right.
And then, you know, a few weeks later, the Timbers beat Real Salt Lake 1-0 at home. So I think that should tell you about the, like, how much gap there is between the best teams and the worst teams in this league.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, Toronto is going to lose a lot of games. At the end of the season, they're going to be one of the worst teams in the league, I think, unless, you know, something fairly drastic changes. But, you know, they are still a professional team that is capable of, under the right circumstances, I think, competing with any team in this league. And, you know, the Sounders made them look terrible. And Aaron Vinter, in his postgame comments, I don't have them right in front of me, but to paraphrase, said, you know, I'm not exactly sure why the team was playing that style. This isn't what we're trying to institute here. He's definitely tried to bring a more continental approach to the team and maybe play a little bit more along the ground. And they've had some success doing that. They've looked a lot better at times this season. And you know, after they really had to abandon that approach fairly early, and I think that that's just because of the pressure that was being put on by the Sounders. You know, Siggy did everything right in terms of his tactical approach to that game. I think that he recognized Toronto's weaknesses, and I think he knew that if the Sounders came out and were able to attack from the beginning and, you know, play a game where they kept possession in Toronto's final third, which I think they did fairly well, that Toronto was not going to be able to get comfortable and play the more free-flowing style that they would like to play and that they're probably more dangerous playing. So, Yeah, I mean, it's anytime you do that to another team in this league, you have to be impressed by it. And would I feel better if it had happened against the Galaxy or Real Salt Lake or, you know, the Red Bulls? Well, yeah, of course I would. But that doesn't mean it wasn't impressive and that we shouldn't be encouraged by it.
Right. And you know, it's 3 points or 3 points. It doesn't matter if you're getting, you know, at the end of the day, the team with the most points, it's not the team that beats the team that everyone thinks is the best team the most times. So, I mean, obviously, we need to beat the Galaxy. We need to beat RSL. We need to beat, you know, whoever else is considered an elite team right now. But at the same point, you also need to beat the teams that are not the best teams in the league, because those points count just as much in the standings and they count just as much towards making the playoffs and you know, all that kind of stuff. One thing I do want to I feel like we should talk about is a little bit of the actual shape that the Sounders were in. It was still a 4-4-2, I think we would probably agree, but it was much more of a diamond 4-4-2, where you have more of an attacking central midfielder, you have a true defensive central midfielder, and you have two midfielders that are not really wings as much as they are, you know, much more tucked in than you would normally get. And so the width you're creating in that situation is coming more from your fullbacks. I mean, you're much more tactical than I am. Why don't you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Well, what it kind of reminded me of is a formation that Chelsea has used to some success, I guess, in the past, in the recent past. I'm almost hesitant to call what Evans and Alvaro were playing wide midfield positions. They weren't central midfielders, but they did a lot of cutting in. I think that in transition, they definitely cut out to the sides and sort of provided width to the defense if the fullbacks had been pushing forward. But they weren't wingers. I think that much should be apparent. And, you know, that width did come from the fullbacks. And I think that what that does is that when you've got 7 or 8 players in attack and, you know, you're getting supply from the outside from the fullbacks, and then, you know, you've got the entire outside of the box covered, it makes it hard for the opposition to counter if there's a deflection. And I just really think that ability to dominate the midfield, because, you know, the Sounders were on equal terms in the midfield. And a lot of the time, you know, if you're playing against a team that's playing a 4-4 or a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1 or, you know, whatever, if there are more than two central midfielders, you're giving away numbers, and it makes it harder to win the midfield battle. I don't think I've ever seen the Sounders dominate the midfield battle like that. It wasn't just Ozzie Alonso. And I think the shape has a lot to do with that. And there were a lot of triangles going on in possession. Eric Freeburg and Freddie Montero and Alvaro and Brad Evans, you know, were a triangle. Then you had one where you take out Freddie and you put in Osvaldo. And, you know, there was just so much more fluidity to it. And you said earlier that you didn't really see the Sounders go to the long ball at any point, and that's because they didn't have to. There was never a sense that they felt like they couldn't get the ball through the midfield. And I think, you know, the shape has a lot to do with that. And when you have someone like Steve Zakuani that you can put out wide, maybe that's not, you know, the best strategy to employ, because if he is your most dynamic player, you know, using that sort of shape maybe takes away some of that advantage, because you can't. It's a lot easier to get around a fullback than it is to split a fullback and a center back. And you know, but for what the Sounders have now, I loved that shape. I think Mauro Rosales would slip into that shape wonderfully, either in the center or on the right. I thought Freeburg was able to play a lot more to his strengths, because, you know, giveaways that he might have had, I don't think were as big of a deal. I thought Evans looked great, and, you know, I want to touch on and say that if Evans was playing as a right winger, I don't think he would be that good. But because he was more of a right attacking midfielder, where he could switch off with Freeburg, he could get involved in the defense a little bit more, he could play as more of a box-to-box mid, I think it's the best of both worlds with Brad Evans. And I think that, you know, that's I think what Ziggy sees him doing all the time as a central box-to-box mid, and it just shows up more when he's in more of an attacking role, when he doesn't have as many defensive responsibilities.
And so going forward, I guess the question now becomes, how do the Sounders take the success that they had on Saturday, which is obvious? But one of the things, or the other reason that they were playing a much tighter central midfield was because Mauro Rosales was also out. And he's, I think we can probably agree, is much more in the Steve Zakuani wide midfielder type of role. And I'm wondering, you know, it's I think you got a situation where you have, there's no way Brad Evans is going to be put on the bench. You got to imagine Alvaro Fernandez is not going to be put on the bench. Eric Freeburg to me seems like the most obvious candidate to go to the bench, but he's also he was also a big part of the attack on Saturday. And I mean, to me, I kind of imagine that Mauro is probably going to start out on the right. You're going to have Alvaro on the left, and even if you don't see it on Wednesday, I think at the very least you're going to see Mauro play either Wednesday or the following Saturday against Columbus. And I'm just wondering, I mean, how do you think you take the what we learned from that game on Saturday and translate it into, okay, well, we want to make sure to have all our best personnel on the field, and how do you make that work, you think?
Well, I think that, you know, you're right. When Mauro comes back, the diamond might not be what Siggy goes to. I'd still like to see it, because even though I think Mauro is a wide midfielder, you know, there's nothing preventing him from cutting out and you know, providing width to the attack. He doesn't have to play the same, even though he's playing the same position, he doesn't have to play it the same way that Brad Evans does. I'm not sure if that's likely to happen, because I do think that Siggy is most comfortable with the 4-2-3-1, or, you know, however you want to call it, the arrow. And I think that Mauro allows you to do that to a little bit greater of an extent. I think the one thing, though, that this game showed is that the Sounders can employ a rotation. You know, Mauro doesn't seem like he is ever going to be 100% dependable in terms of 90 minutes every game in terms of his fitness, right? Which, you know, is understandable. There's not really a lot he can do about that. But I think with the situation you have now, you know, if anyone is out for a game or two, you don't have to really be that concerned about it, because you've got someone that can slot in. I think you're right that Freeburg is probably the one that will and should go to the bench, but there's still every opportunity for him to get a lot of time, to get, you know, a fair amount of starts. You can have a legitimate rotation now, and I think we'd all prefer to have Steve Zakuani start every game, but, you know, that rotation is going to allow players to stay a little bit fresher. It's going to allow you to exploit matchups a little bit more. If you've got a team with maybe slower fullbacks, then yeah, put Mauro out wide, and he can use some of that pace. If you've got teams that maybe like to play back a little bit more and that you have to unlock, then maybe we'll see something like we saw on Saturday night. I think that there are a lot of options, and I think that the game on Saturday showed the flexibility that this team has, and that's never a bad thing to have.
Yeah, and I think that probably the other areas that you're going to continue to see some rotation is, I think if there's one thing that Siggy has shown us in the first 8 games now, is that there are not 2 starting center backs. He essentially has 3 starting center backs, and all of them are going to be used. You know, I think I was certainly guilty of starting to believe that Jeff Park and John Kennedy Hurtado were the starting center backs, or that there was even going to be a starting center back duo picked. But the last 4 games, I guess now, I think if there's one thing we've learned, it's that no one of these guys is heads and shoulders above the other one. Hurtado looks the best when he's playing the best, but he's also had some really bad moments, which, you know, is fine. He's coming back from a very serious injury. And the reality is that they have 2 other center backs that are perfectly capable. Pat Ioane had probably his best game in, I don't remember how, I mean, he looked absolutely stellar against Toronto. And that was, I don't know when the last time we could say that about Pat Ioane. Maybe he was inspired. Maybe, I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, he had an absolutely awesome game. And Tyson Wall, I think, is probably, I don't know that he's above Leo Gonzalez on the depth chart, but he's probably got to the point now where he needs to be played. He doesn't maybe need to start, you know, 20 games this year, but they're going to have to find a way to get Tyson Wall on the field. And I think that you're probably going to see a lot of rotation there. I think it's pretty clear that you're going to see a lot of rotation in the midfield. You know, I think Freddie Montero is your starting, you know, withdrawn forward. I don't think anyone's really going to question that. Well, no one that pays attention is going to question that. But, you know, I think that what we're going to see is I think the Sounders probably have 15 guys that are going to get significant playing time for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, what you were saying about the center backs, I think that with the style that the Sounders came out playing on Saturday night, the selections of Hurtado and Ioane make a lot of sense. You know, Park might be a slightly better pure defensive player, but he's not as good with the ball at his feet as Ioane. He's not as dangerous in terms of maybe starting dangerous attacks from the rear as Ioane is. So if you, you know, maybe want to have a little bit more playmaking ability, I don't know if that's the right word, but a little bit more ability and possession at the back in favor of some defense, you know, maybe Ioane is a good call there. And yeah, you know, even Montero, I think, even though he's probably the most important player on the team at this point in time, you know, Rosales can slot in for him if he needs a day off. We're going to end up having some fixture congestion at some point once the Champions League starts and once the Open Cup gets in the swing. And there's time for a lot of players. I think that this team is going to definitely be taking the Open Cup seriously again this year. So, yeah, I mean, it's the flexibility that this team has. I think we talked a lot about the depth and the flexibility coming into the season, and then it maybe seemed like it was going to be a situation where that wasn't used to its fullest. And, you know, obviously the way that it got to the point where it was used to its fullest is not ideal. But, you know, it's there, and it's why we had it. And honestly, I feel kind of like an idiot for suggesting that maybe the Sounders were going to have to consider trading one of Brad Evans or Eric Freeberg.
At this point in the season, it seems, I mean, in hindsight, it does seem rather preposterous to think that one of those guys was going to have to be traded, because I think I was probably agreeing with you to a degree that it just seemed like you had too many talented bodies to justify, you know, the expense on the roster. But at this point, it couldn't be playing out. I mean, they need all those players right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause I mean, you know, if they can't play, if one of the players that were healthy Saturday night couldn't play, I think the Sounders probably still win that game, but you're into even more of an interesting situation. And you know, there are going to be times this year where one or more of those guys that you know, are kind of constitute the midfield rotation are not going to be available for whatever reason due to suspension or injury or, you know, just needing a day off or whatever. So, I think that the Sounders are well-equipped pretty much everywhere except maybe forward to compete in multiple competitions. And I think that the fact that you can say that, considering that two starting players are done for, in Zach Ioane's case, the majority, if not all, of the season, and O'Brien White's for, you know, who knows how long. The fact that they still have depth as a strength is, I think, impressive, and I think that a lot of credit needs to go to Siggy and needs to go to Adrian Hanauer and everyone involved in making those decisions and making those acquisitions, because it's really paying off. You can see its value, for sure.
Yeah, I think that we can't really say enough about the Sounders' ability to stockpile talent this offseason. You know, they didn't have a lot of flexibility. I actually had a conversation with Adrian Hanauer over the weekend about what kind of options the Sounders have in front of them in terms of, or not over the weekend, I guess it was on Friday, about what kind of options they have. And, you know, he basically indicated that there aren't a lot of options in the immediate future. He made it sound like they were pretty dead set on finding an attacking player at this point. But, you know, they're definitely open to different ideas. But in a way, it almost seems like they were better off not picking up somebody, you know, 2 weeks ago before all these injuries happened. that, you know, he didn't say that, but that was kind of my kind of putting my own interpretation was, you know, if they had found somebody 2 weeks ago, you know, maybe it's not exactly the kind of player that they need at this point, since they have different kinds of needs. But I think that they've done a pretty amazing job putting this team together, and, you know, who knows where it all goes from here. But I think we can at least say that there's enough talent here to, you know, be competitive.
Oh, absolutely.
And even make a serious run at one of these titles.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I want to just touch real fast on what you said about maybe if they make a decision on a designated player, say, or some other impact acquisition 2 weeks ago, it's not the same type of player they'd be looking for now. I think that's absolutely right. I think that 2 years ago, probably the number one priority would have been a target forward. At this point, I'm not really sure if a target forward in the Blaise Coufeau mold, or, you know, that sort of player, a pure target forward, is really what the Sounders are going to be after. A target forward is a lot less valuable when you don't have someone with Steve Zakuani's pace on the outside, and the Sounders aren't going to have that for the rest of the year. So maybe they look for more of a pure scorer. You know, maybe they look for something of a goal poacher, as opposed to someone who can hold up play and, you know, let the transition happen. Because, you know, if the Sounders are going to be doing a lot of possession-based things like they did against Toronto, where they just try to work the ball up slowly and hang on to it a lot in the attacking end, a target forward is really kind of a luxury. It's not really something that really is as beneficial as someone that can find the right position for rebounds, that can make dangerous runs and draw the defense to him and open up spots for, you know, for a fullback coming up or what have you. So, yeah, I mean, it has to change what they're looking for. It has to maybe widen the net a little bit, so to speak. And, you know, I guess you can give credit to the front office in that case as well for saying, you know, we don't really have to make a move right now. We want to bring in an impact player. We want to bring in, you know, a designated player, quality player to play forward. So maybe we should hold off until we kind of know more where we're at before we make that decision.
Yeah, and I think that if they get credit for anything, it's not that they knew that anything bad was going to happen. I think if they had found the perfect player 2 weeks ago, in fact, Adrian said if they had found the perfect player 2 weeks ago, they would have signed up the perfect player 2 weeks ago, and they would have figured out how best to use them in light of everything. That said, I think it's credit to them for not panicking, for not feeling like, well, we just lost a designated player. Our fans want us to bring somebody in. We have this money. Let's go. We just need to find someone with a name that we can kind of latch ourselves onto. And instead, they, you know, obviously they were, you know, going about it in a much more measured way. And they did the appropriate thing, which was to, you know, rather than get someone that find the imperfect person that you can get now, I'd like to think that they'll be able to find the closer to perfect person. Just they have to wait till June or July or whenever the transfer. I guess it's July. Is that right? July 15th?
Is it July?
I think it is July. I keep saying June, but Adrian said July, and I bet Adrian knows better than I do.
I would hope so. No offense to you, but I would hope that he does.
I know. That would be. I guess I'd be a little worried if I knew better than him.
Yeah. I think that, you know, obviously, anytime you find the perfect player, that's the perfect situation, you pounce on it. But I think what you said is absolutely right. There was no sense of panic, and there never has been with this team and with this front office. And you know, this team just needs to play up to its potential until a new designated player can be brought in. If they can do that, they're still going to be in most of the important races. If they're not, if this team is playing to their potential and they're not in the supporters' shield race by the time the transfer window opens up, then I don't think the right designated player was going to keep them in it. And, you know, you've got to, as much as I want to win the supporters' shield, as much as I want to be, you know, the US Open Cup champion again, I also am concerned about the long-term health of the team. I mean, this is still a team with a fairly young core, and, you know, Steve Zakuani is going to be back next year, and we hope, and I think have reason to believe, at full strength. And, you know, that maybe next year is going to be the year, so you don't want to panic and bring in somebody that's going to, well, I don't know, end up quitting 2 days or 2 hours before the season starts because they're not happy. So yeah, you know, I'm not disappointed that there was not a panic move made, I guess.
And not to beat that too badly into the ground, but let's not forget that the Sounders lost Blaise Kufo, you know, just days before the start of the season. They start the season with 2 losses. They go 4 games without a win. And there were a lot of reasons for, you know, there was a lot of people calling for it. Maybe we joined that chorus to a certain degree. But I can't imagine that it was easy for the Sounders to kind of sit on their hands and wait for the right person. And, you know, maybe we're giving them too much credit. You know, maybe they tried to sign someone up and they just can get someone to put their name on the dotted line. But I tend to think that it was a little more, you know, it was a little more handled than that. But anyway, we do have an interview with Travis Clark, who covers DC United for MLS Soccer. And we should probably send it over to him, to that. And we'll be back and we'll talk a little bit about the Columbus game. And maybe we'll talk about the Chris Brown, yeah, 3 times video. We're here with Travis Clark, who writes for MLS Soccer, as well as what other sites do you write for? He covers DC United, but who else do you write for, Travis?
I write for anyone who will pay me to write about soccer, including I do ESPN.com's weekly MLS fantasy preview, actually, if you've checked that out. I will be covering Wednesday night's game for the Sounder, for the Seattle Times, as well as doing an advance for Saturday's game at Columbus, so be sure to check all that out in the paper.
Let's, man, you're keeping yourself busy over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm lucky. I get to write about soccer for a living, so can't complain about that.
No, definitely not. So, DC United, Sounders are going to be playing there on Wednesday. What is going on with this team? It seems like, looking at them from a distance, it looks like a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde team in a way, that they beat the Columbus Crew, I believe, what was it, 3-1 on on opening week, and then they have, who else did they beat? Toronto 3-0, but they have the tie against the Galaxy, and then the rest of their games they've all been blown out in, essentially. I mean, what's your kind of your take on what's going on there?
Honestly, it's a team that's rebuilding a lot. It's in transition, so it's really hard to explain, actually. You know, I like your Jekyll and Hyde theory because, you know, they've had games where against Columbus where they've done really well, but also at the crux of that, the teams they played have come off very poorly, and, you know, there's a whole lot of things going on, but it's a really young team. Probably, I think there was an article out there that they're the youngest team in the league if Onstad hadn't started, so, you know, there was games where you had Ethan White, Perry Kitchen, and Chris Corp, in all three who are rookies, in defense. Bill Hamid is 20, so you're going to have moments where you're going to have mental lapses, mistakes, but they were pretty pissed about the effort on Friday. A lot of dejected heads, and Ben Olsen was not very talkative to reporters after today's training session. So it's going to be a big game. They're really going to want to bounce back Wednesday night. They have 3 games at home where if this team is going to do anything this year, they've got to come out of them with at least 7 to 9 points. So, you know, it's kind of tough from my perspective how to call it, and I haven't seen enough of Seattle to see how the two teams really going to match up, although I know that I've covered all 3 Sounders games out here, and Sounders have won all 3 of those, so it's going to be an interesting matchup for sure.
So I guess one of those must have been the U.S. Open Cup final?
Mm-hmm.
What and was, and then the 2 regular season games, right?
Yeah.
And so just for the sake of walking us down memory lane, because that was such a great moment, what was the what was that U.S. Open Cup final like?
Well, it was pretty cool because, you know, everyone remembers the Weidman Trophies campaign that was certainly polarizing, but certainly worked because they had a good crowd for I believe it was a midweek matchup, and U.S. Open Cup games have never been a big draw, you know, outside of certain places, so it was certainly a good matchup, but then a disappointment. I believe, I could be getting things mistaken, is that the one where Wick stomped on Freddie and got the red card? So
it
obviously
is,
you have the red mist moment kind of hanging over that. And I can't really remember the distinct nuances of the game. I remember taking the subway home, or the metro, as we call it out here, and Sounders fans were on the metro back, and they were, of course, pumped up and excited. And there was a It was a good traveling camp. I remember the celebration. I think I was hit champagne a couple of times in the locker room. Drew Carey was there. You know, it was a pretty fun experience if you're not a DC United fan, that's for sure.
Well, getting back to this year's DC United team, one of the things that jumps out at me as just someone who, again, who isn't watching the team every week but is paying attention to the results and seeing what's going on there is Andy Nahar seems to have been suddenly pushed into the background. Is that something that's Is something going on there that maybe the national media doesn't see?
Honestly, no. He showed up to camp a little bit off shape and hasn't really hit the same stride. And when he's played, he's shown the ability to get into dangerous spots. But one thing that lacked DC last year that they still haven't really rectified was getting the ball into the final third and then, you know, delivering that killer pass to a guy who's in space or a guy who's making the right run. So Andy has... He actually was sick, was supposed to start in Toronto and was sick, and has since then just started from the bench. And I think we'll see him in the starting lineup Wednesday. I think it's just been a matter of bringing him along slowly, tempering expectations, and combining with the distraction of the Honduras USA nonsense, and then, you know, coming into camp not in his best shape. So it's been a variety of things happening. Nothing that I think should turn heads significantly, and I think you'll see Andy back to his best here shortly.
And so speaking of the whole Honduras USA thing, do you think he was really ever very close to choosing the US? I mean, it always seemed to make a lot more sense for him to play for Honduras.
No, I never thought he would. I thought I was one of the few people who didn't really think it much of a story, but obviously it is a story, so it's a story you have to report. So, you know, the guy isn't eligible to play for the US, and he can play international soccer now. Why in the world would he wait and then risk not playing? Like, it doesn't make sense to me.
No, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me either. I mean, in kind of the same way that, you know, I mean, it seems like the situations where guys choose to play for the U.S., it's almost always because they already have citizenship or they already have a path to, I mean, like a very clear path to being able to choose to play here. You know, if a guy has to wait, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years in some cases, it always seems like it's a little bit of a just kind of hopeful wishing for, you know, U.S. soccer fans to say, oh, well, we could get this guy. He plays in the U.S. and he has a green card.
Yeah, I mean, then also consider Andy is, what, he's 18 and he has played one season in MLS. Like, I think there should be more hype if this has been his third year. He was closing on U.S. citizenship maybe next year. Then I think you have more of a debate and more of a, like, will he or won't he? But, you know, he's had one good season. He had a good season on a really bad team. So let's see what he does this year. Let's see what he does next year before we really be like, oh, we want him to play for the U.S. or whatever.
And so not to beat this too far into the ground, but how good was Andy Nahar last year? I mean, obviously we've seen the highlights. We see the numbers. The numbers don't necessarily jump out at you, but, you know, watching him in bits and pieces, it looks like he had a pretty impressive season. But you saw him play a lot more than I did and than most people did. I mean, what's your take on what this guy's ceiling is and how good he really can be and has been?
He's a really fun player to watch. You know, he's explosive. He's got great speed. He's almost reminiscent of Zach Wani, who I'm a big fan of in terms of that, you know, true winger flank play. This season, in his first couple of games, I was impressed with Andy's defense because that was always my concern. A little bit last year looked like, you know, it's not that he couldn't keep up, but he was making the jump from high school soccer to MLS, essentially. And so, you know, there were times when his defense was lacking and times where you're like, well, if he's on a better team, is he playing as much as he is? So I think that, you know, the early parts of this season, he's going to really kind of show who he can possibly be, especially, the second half of the season, sorry. He'll show more of that potential and if he's really going to be that great player. Because I think what really separates him at this point, you know, from being, you know, that one of the best players in the league is his final ball. Like, this, the delivery on the wing when he has it in a dangerous spot isn't consistent enough. It can be good, but it's not consistent enough as it needs to be in order for him to really be that, you know, upper echelon player, in my opinion.
And so just real quick, a quick scouting report at DC United. Who are the players that Sounders fans should be watching for, and who are the guys that, you know, maybe are getting a little bit more hype than they maybe deserve?
Yeah, it's hard to call at this point. I think there are going to be a number of changes to the lineup after Friday night's loss. How drastic that is, of course, coaches are playing that close to their chests. But, you know, Davies has 5 goals. Obviously, 3 of those are penalty kicks, as people will point out. But he makes the smart runs, puts himself into dangerous positions. There were some interesting backline combinations going on today. That Dejan Jakovic, Perry Kitchen, Ethan White might make a return. Who's another academy player. So it's interesting to point out that DC's defense, their oldest player is 26. So that in and of itself talks about how young the defense is. And in terms of your attacking guys, like along with Davies, Chris Pontius is healthy, and that's a big asset for United going forward on the wings. Because if you have Pontius on one hand, on one side, Nahar on the other side, then you have a pretty lethal wing combination that can punish teams when they're on.
And Pontius, of course, scored, at the day of the game, it was called a hat trick against the Sounders when the game at Seattle, but I believe he got one of those goals taken away for some, I don't remember the reasoning, maybe he didn't quite get a head on it or something, but Pontius is the guy that scored 2 goals against the Sounders at Seattle last year, right?
Yeah, he is. I believe it was given to Adam Christman because he had, gotten a hand on either that or it was an own goal, because I remember watching that game.
Right.
Being pretty stunned at the result, especially because they had that late fight back at the end too, correct?
I think they may have scored 2 stoppage time goals to cut the lead.
So, yeah, Pontius has shown the ability to be dangerous and finish his chances against Toronto. Of course, he hasn't done, statistically speaking, hasn't done much since then. And, he's been one of those guys who won Branko Boskovic's left wing spot and has kind of kept him out of the lineup. So, he can be dangerous when he's in form, and I think he's getting close to being in form and fit 100%
at least. Last question, and I'll let you get out of here. What can you tell us about the Branko Boskovic situation? I know he tore his ACL. He appeared to be just kind of rounding into shape. He had scored 2 goals in a U.S. Open Cup match. First of all, what's the prognosis on if and when he might come back? And what was your take on his time in D.C.?
I was kind of puzzled as to why he wasn't starting from the get-go. There was talk about him not being in shape, him showing up, not ideal weight. I'm not really sure. I can't really. Anything I'd say is really just speculation. They are getting official word, I believe, today or early tomorrow, and I'll probably have to scoot back out the training tomorrow just to kind of get an official idea of what's going on. The club announced on Twitter Friday night that he has a torn ACL. That's 4 to 6 months, and I'm not really sure what this. He had a follow-up appointment with the team doctor or something like that. So I haven't really heard anything more than that. And honestly, when you watch him play, he's a very classy player, does a lot of things that few people in MLS can do as in terms of technical-wise, and really gave DC someone that can hit a free kick well, which is something that well and consistently, which is something that is lacking, because Santino Carranza and Dax McCarty have shown the ability, flashes of set-piece delivery, but sometimes it can be spotty and not as dangerous as Boskovic. As, I don't know if you remember seeing him hit the crossbar against New York. So it's a tough blow to lose a player like that. There's no salary cap relief, and he'll go on the injured list, which they don't expect anything different, so I think it's just kind of a last, let's just make sure that everything, we're on the same page and before we make the official announcement. So they've been tight about that, minus, of course, revealing on Twitter and the things that I think Steve Goff reported. So, wait and see.
And so people, I had read some speculation that this could actually be the end of his DC United career. Is that outlandish, or is there a pretty good possibility that if he's really out 6 months that that DC might just not bring him back, and then that essentially ends the Branko Boskovic era, if you can call it that.
I'm not sure at this point. I don't know off the top of my head where his contract is guaranteed through. I believe it could be he came mid-season last year, so it could be through mid-season 2012, like he signed.
We're here with Travis Clark, who writes for MLS Soccer, as well as what other sites do you write for? He covers DC United, but who else do you write for, Travis?
I write for anyone who will pay me to write about soccer, including I do ESPN.com's weekly MLS fantasy preview, actually, if you've checked that out. I will be covering Wednesday night's game for the Sounder for the Seattle Times, as well as doing an advance for Saturday's game at Columbus. So be sure to check all that out in the paper.
Let's, man, you're keeping yourself busy over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm lucky. I get to write about soccer for a living, so can't complain about that.
No, definitely not. So, DC United, Sounders are going to be playing there on Wednesday. What is going on with this team? It seems like looking at them from a distance, it looks like a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde team in a way that they beat the Columbus Crew. I believe, what was it, 3-1 on on opening week, and then they have who else did they beat? Toronto 3-0, but they have the tie against the Galaxy, and then the rest of their games they've all been blown out in essentially. I mean, what's your kind of your take on what's going on there?
Honestly, it's a team that's rebuilding a lot. It's in transition, so it's really hard to explain, actually. You know, I like your Jekyll and Hyde theory because, you know, they've had games where against Columbus where they've done really well, but also at the crux of that, the teams they've played have come off very poorly, and, you know, there's a whole lot of things going on, but it's a really young team. Probably, I think there was an article out there that they're the youngest team in the league if Onstad hadn't started, so, you know, there was games where you had Ethan White, Perry Kitchen, and Chris Corp, in all three who are rookies, in defense. Bill Hamid is 20. So you're going to have moments where you're going to have mental lapses, mistakes, but they were pretty pissed about the effort on Friday. A lot of dejected heads, and Ben Olsen was not very talkative to reporters after today's training session. So it's going to be a big game. They're really going to want to bounce back Wednesday night. They have three games at home where if this team is going to do anything this year, they've got to come out of them with at least 7 to 9 points. So, you know, it's kind of tough from my perspective how to call it, and I haven't seen enough of Seattle to see how the two teams really going to match up, although I know that I've covered all three Sounders games out here, and Sounders have won all three of those, so it's going to be an interesting matchup for sure.
So I guess one of those must have been the U.S. Open Cup final.
Mm-hmm.
What and was, the, you know, just, and then the two regular season games, right?
Yeah.
And so just for the sake of walking us down memory lane, because that was such a great moment, what was the what was that U.S. Open Cup final like?
Well, it was pretty cool because, you know, everyone remembers the Weidman Trophies campaign that was certainly polarizing, but certainly worked because they had a good crowd for I believe it was a midweek matchup, and U.S. Open Cup games have never been a big draw, you know, outside of certain places, so it was certainly a good matchup, but then a disappointment. I believe, I could be getting things mistaken, is that the one where Wick stomped on Freddie and got the red card? So
it
obviously
is,
you have the red mist moment kind of hanging over that. And I can't really remember the distinct nuances of the game. I remember taking the subway home, or the Metro, as we call it out here, and Sounders fans were on the Metro back, and they were, of course, pumped up and excited. And there was a... It was a good traveling camp. I remember the celebration. I think I was hit champagne a couple of times in the locker room. Drew Carey was there. You know, it was a pretty fun experience if you're not a DC United fan, that's for sure.
Well, getting back to this year's DC United team, one of the things that jumps out at me as just someone who, again, who isn't watching the team every week but is paying attention to the results and seeing what's going on there, is Andy Nahar seems to have been suddenly pushed into the background. Is that something that's... Is something going on there that maybe the national media doesn't see?
Honestly, no. He showed up to camp a little bit off shape and hasn't really hit the same stride. And when he's played, he's shown the ability to get into dangerous spots. But one thing that lacked to DC last year that they still haven't really rectified was getting the ball into the final third and then, you know, delivering that killer pass to a guy who's in space or a guy who's making the right run. So Andy has... He actually was sick, was supposed to start in Toronto and was sick, and has since then just started from the bench. And I think we'll see him in the starting lineup Wednesday. I think it's just been a matter of bringing him along slowly, tempering expectations, and combined with the distraction of the Honduras USA nonsense, and then, you know, coming into camp not in his best shape. So it's been a variety of things happening. Nothing that I think should turn heads significantly, and I think you'll see Andy back to his best here shortly.
And so speaking of the whole Honduras USA thing, do you think he was really ever very close to choosing the U.S.? I mean, it always seemed to make a lot more sense for him to play for Honduras.
No, I never thought he would. I thought I was one of the few people who didn't really think it much of a story, but obviously it is a story, so it's a story you have to report. So you know, the guy isn't eligible to play for the U.S., and he can play international soccer now. Why in the world would he wait and then risk not playing? Like, it doesn't make sense to me.
No, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me either. I mean, in kind of the same way that, you know, I mean, it seems like the situations where guys choose to play for the U.S., it's almost always because they already have citizenship or they already have a path to, I mean, like a very clear path to being able to choose to play here. You know, if a guy has to wait, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years in some cases, it always seems like it's a little bit of a just kind of hopeful wishing for, you know, U.S. soccer fans to say, oh, well, we could get this guy. He plays in the U.S. and he has a green card.
Yeah, I mean, then also consider Andy is, what, he's 18 and he has played one season in MLS. Like, I think there should be more hype if this has been his third year. He was closing on U.S. citizenship maybe next year. Then I think you have more of a debate and more of a, like, will he or won't he? But, you know, he's had one good season. He had a good season on a really bad team. So let's see what he does this year. Let's see what he does next year before we really be like, oh, we want him to play for the U.S. or whatever.
And so not to beat this too far into the ground, but how good was Andy Nahar last year? I mean, obviously we've seen the highlights. We see the numbers. The numbers don't necessarily jump out at you, but, you know, watching him in bits and pieces, it looks like he had a pretty impressive season. But you saw him play a lot more than I did and than most people did. I mean, what's your take on what this guy's ceiling is and how good he really can be and has been?
He's a really fun player to watch. You know, he's explosive. He's got great speed. He's almost reminiscent of Zach Wani, who I'm a big fan of in terms of that, you know, true winger flank play. This season, in his first couple of games, I was impressed with Andy's defense because that was always my concern. A little bit last year looked like, you know, it's not that he couldn't keep up, but he was making the jump from high school soccer to MLS, essentially. And so, you know, there were times when his defense was lacking and times where you're like, well, if he's on a better team, is he playing as much as he is? So I think that, you know, the early parts of this season, he's going to really kind of show who he can possibly be, especially, the second half of the season, sorry. He'll show more of that potential and if he's really going to be that great player. Because I think what really separates him at this point, you know, from being – you know, that one of the best players in the league is his final ball. Like, this, the delivery on the wing when he has it in a dangerous spot isn't consistent enough. It can be good, but it's not consistent enough as it needs to be in order for him to really be that, you know, upper echelon player, in my opinion.
And so just real quick, a quick scouting report at DC United. Who are the players that Sounders fans should be watching for, and who are the guys that, you know, maybe are getting a little bit more hype than they maybe deserve?
It's hard to call at this point. I think there are going to be a number of changes to the lineup after Friday night's loss. How drastic that is, of course, coaches are playing that close to their chests. But, you know, Davies has 5 goals. Obviously, 3 of those are penalty kicks, as people will point out. But, he, you know, he makes the smart runs, puts himself into dangerous positions. There are some interesting backline combinations going on today that, who, you know, Dejan Jakovic, Perry Kitchen, Ethan White might make a return, who's another academy player. So it's interesting to point out that DC's defense, their oldest player is 26. So, you know, that in and of itself talks about how young the defense is. And in terms of your attacking guys, like along with Davies, Chris Pontius is healthy, and that's a big asset for United going forward on the wings. Because if you have Pontius on one hand, on one side, Nahar on the other side, then you have, you know, a pretty lethal wing combination that can punish teams when they're on.
And Pontius, of course, scored, at the day of the game, it was called a hat trick against the Sounders when the game at Seattle, but I believe he got one of those goals taken away for some, I don't remember the reasoning, maybe he didn't quite get a head on it or something, but Pontius is the guy that scored 2 goals against the Sounders at Seattle last year, right?
Yeah, he is. I believe it was given to Adam Chrisman because he had like gotten a hand on either that or it was an own goal. Because I remember watching that game
right,
and being pretty stunned at the result, especially because they had that late fight back at the end too. Correct?
Yeah. I think they may have scored 2 stoppage time goals to cut the lead.
So yeah, Pontius has shown the ability to be dangerous and finish his chances against Toronto. Of course, he hasn't done. Statistically speaking, hasn't done much since then, and you know they're, you know, he's been one of those guys who won Branko Boskovic's left wing spot and has kind of kept him out of the lineup. So You know, he can be dangerous when he's in form, and I think he's getting close to being in form and fit 100%.
So last question, and I'll let you get out of here. What can you tell us about the Bronco Boskovich situation? I know he tore his ACL. He appeared to be just kind of rounding into shape. He had scored 2 goals in a U.S. Open Cup match. First of all, what's the prognosis on if and when he might come back? And what was your take on his time in D.C.?
You know, I was kind of puzzled as to why he wasn't starting from the get-go. There was talk about him not being in shape, him showing up, you know, not ideal weight. I'm not really sure. I can't really – anything I say is really just speculation. They are getting official word, I believe, today or early tomorrow, and I'll probably have to scoot back out the training tomorrow just to kind of get an official idea of what's going on. You know, the club announced on Twitter Friday night that he has a torn ACL. That's 4 to 6 months, and I'm not really sure what this – he had a follow-up appointment with the team doctor or something like that. So I haven't really heard anything more than that, and honestly, when you watch him play, he's a very classy player, does a lot of things that, you know, few people in MLS can do as in terms of technical-wise, and really gave DC someone that can hit a free kick well, which is something that – well and consistently, which is something that is lacking, because Santino Carranza and Dax McCarty have shown the ability, like flashes of set-piece delivery, but you know, sometimes it can be spotty and, you know, not as dangerous as Boskovich. As, I don't know if you remember seeing him hit the crossbar against New York. So it's a tough blow to lose a player like that. There's no salary cap relief, and he'll go on the injured list, which they don't expect anything different. So I think it's just kind of a last, let's just make sure that everything, we're on the same page and before we make the official announcement. So they haven't really, they've been tight about that, minus, of course, revealing on Twitter and the things that I think Steve Goff reported. So, wait and see.
And so people, I had read some speculation that this could actually be the end of his DC United career. Is that outlandish, or is there a pretty good possibility that if he's really out 6 months that that DC might just not bring him back, and then that essentially ends the Bronco Boskovich era, if you can call it that?
I'm not sure at this point. I don't know off the top of my head where his contract is guaranteed through. I believe it could be he came mid-season last year, so it could be through mid-season 2012, like he signed 2 years guaranteed contract. Again, I'm not sure, and you could always say that, yes, it's his time is end if this thing isn't handled well and he wants to just agree to a buyout, or, you know, it could be, very well could be, but that's far too early, and, you know, he might come in at the last couple months of the season and still be able to contribute. So there's a lot of kind of things that are swirling around up in the air right now.
And did you get the sense that he liked being in D.C., though? Or did you get the sense that he was – you know, other than not, I mean, was not playing a huge problem, or was it one of those things where, you know, I mean, like, we have our own designated player situation that's been somewhat similar, except Fernandez has been playing a little bit more, but it's similar in that he's been on the bench. I mean, do you get a sense, I don't know how much English he speaks and how much you've talked to him, but do you get a sense of him wanting to be in DC or MLS in general?
Yeah, you know, I haven't talked to him a whole lot. His English is decent, but I haven't really had many conversations to really get a sense of that. I feel like players like that enjoy the opportunity to come over to America, and, you know, it's something that I'm not really sure, and I think that a lot will have to do with how he recovers from this injury and how long he's out. That will sort of affect his desire to stay or what have you. I remember reading that he left Rapid Vienna because of front office problems. So, you know, like I was saying, it's really up in the air, and I'm not sure where he's at. And, you know, his English is good, but he speaks like 5 languages. So it's really fourth on the list, and, you know, some things don't get lost in translation. So it's kind of hard to say right now.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time, Travis. Once again, MLS, read his stuff on MLSsoccer.com. You can read him apparently in this weekend or this Thursday's Seattle Times.
And Saturdays too, I think.
And Saturdays.
Yeah, I'm doing the advance for Columbus because they're flying straight from DC to Columbus.
Geez, I guess they just I wonder how they make those decisions. I guess Josh just isn't going to DC this week, huh? I wonder if he's even going to Columbus. Well, you probably don't know that.
I don't know that.
anyway, I really appreciate you being on, and you know, hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again when DC comes to Seattle. All right. Well, hopefully you enjoyed that interview. Chris is Chris. Why did I just call him Chris? Because I was watching a Chris Brown video. Travis Clark is a good guy, obviously. He knows his stuff. I'm jealous that apparently he's getting paid to do all that stuff. I don't get paid to do nearly as much stuff as I do. So I'm going to have to pick his brain about how to start making real soccer money that he apparently is tapped into. We have another game after DC United that is going to probably be even more telling, I think, in terms of how much we know about this team. And that's the Columbus Crew, a team that the Sounders have beaten the last three. No, they have never lost to, but they've won the last two times that they've played in Columbus. Of course, is Siggy Schmid's old team, which I guess this is actually kind of funny. This is a funny little road trip because both games are pseudo rivalry games. Of course, the DC United rivalry stems from the U.S. Open Cup match the first year, and the Crew stem from Siggy's relationship with them. And they also were the team that the Sounders beat in the Open Cup championship game last year. We don't know a whole lot about the Crew, admittedly. I think that they are actually kind of a funny case study. As you may or may not know, SB Nation every week does power rankings. And basically what we do is we ask all the editors around SB Nation Soccer to put the teams in one of four different tiers. Tier one being the teams they basically say are going to be like the Supporters Shield contenders, and all the way down to tier four, which are the teams that they suspect are going to be competing for the worst record in the league. And then in the middle, you have there's usually a lot of movement between tiers two and three. And in any case, the Crew are kind of a funny little case study in this because they started off as a tier four team. They moved into tier three, I think, probably pretty quickly. But they've been stuck in tier three basically all season, despite the fact that they've gone six games without a loss now in a row. Their only loss of the season was a season opener against DC United. Admittedly, it was a 3-1. It was a pretty bad loss, but they haven't lost in six games. They've played the Red Bulls, and I think part of the problem is that they played a Red Bulls team that was severely shorthanded because of international call-ups and injuries. But they've gotten results. You know, last week they beat Vancouver 2-1, but yet they still find themselves in Tier 3, and there's a bunch of people that are still picking them as Tier 4 teams. And I don't know, what do you think the reason for that is, Aaron?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with people having some notions, some preconceived notions coming into the season. And, you know, that's not at all a criticism because, of course, you have to have them. You have to base, you know, your opinions of teams on what you know. And, you know, the Crew have been successful in terms of their results. But I don't think they've blown anyone away, and so I think people are kind of waiting for the doors to fall off. What's interesting about that is that you could say the same thing about the Philadelphia Union, and yet, you know, the Union are considered by some people to be one of the best teams in the league and a legitimate Supporters Shield competitor, and, you know, the Union haven't really been that much better than the Crew in terms of their results.
No, in fact, in a lot of ways, they've been almost exactly the same. I mean, you could argue that the Crew have been better in the sense that they've actually scored two goals in a game a couple times, whereas the Union have never scored more than a goal.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually tend to agree with you. I think that the Crew are probably a better team than the Union at this point. I think to a certain extent you also do have to take nothing but results into account because, you know, if a first tier team or a first tier team is a Supporters Shield contender and a second tier team is almost a shoe-in for the playoffs, those results obviously matter. It's not necessarily who do you think the best team on pure talent and form alone is. It's, you know, who do you expect to do X. And the more games you win, the easier it is to win the Supporters Shield or makes it to the playoffs or what have you. So, I also think, though, that there are people that have the Crew rated pretty high. I don't know. Have they gotten any first-tier votes yet?
Well, let's look. I'm actually looking at the board right now, and they have the thing that's crazy, they have 3 tier 4 votes right now,
right?
Which is just crazy to me. And I would be, at first I was like, oh, well, these must all be people who haven't been updating their rankings. But no, everyone on here has updated the ranking, and they still are stuck at 3 tier 4 votes. They have a bunch of, you know, the thing that I think is more telling than that, though, is that they have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of the 22 voters consider them to be tier 2. And
right.
this is, I'm not saying that they are a lock to make the playoffs, but I mean, I have them in tier 2, mainly because I think at this point, it's just too hard to deny that they are a team. I mean, I don't know. These rankings are obviously very unscientific, and everyone kind of interprets them however they want to interpret them. I kind of interpret them as being as a representative of current form with some mixture of projection in it. And I mean, the Crew are getting results. They're getting results every week, and they're doing it against decent teams. I mean, they're not doing it in particularly impressive fashion, but I mean, I'll say this is I'm a lot more worried about the Crew than I am about DC United this week. And DC United, you know, looking at our rankings, are not that differently ranked than they are.
Right.
They have 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. They have 7 tier 4 votes, which obviously people are starting to jump off the DC United bandwagon. But at one point, DC United was – I want to say at the beginning of the season, people were calling them a tier 2 team. There was actually one person that had them ranked in tier 1, which was – rather comical.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it is funny the way that perceptions are really dying hard. And I was one of those people who was as hard on the Crew as anybody at the start of the season. But they are not a bad team right now. I mean, they might not be a fun team to watch, but they are not a bad team.
No, I mean, I had the Crew in tier 4 for weeks, probably longer than I should have. But, you know, I think that people overreact to small sample sizes. And I think that now we're getting to the point where we're getting close to a quarter of the way through the season, and you have to definitely start reevaluating some of your opinions. And the Crew are, I mean, the Crew and DC are similar in a lot of ways, more so than their power rankings. They're both kind of they're teams that were amongst the class of the league for years and years and years that have kind of forced to start rebuilding. And at this point, it kind of seems like the Crew have had a little bit more success in that process. It's not really that dissimilar to maybe the way FC Dallas kind of came out of nowhere to surprise a lot of people last year, from going from really being one of the worst teams in the league to being, at certain points, looking like the best team in the league. And I'm not saying the Crew are there yet, obviously, but that's kind of the thing with this league is, the level that it's at, you're going to end up with a lot of players coming into the league and coming into more prominent roles that you don't really know a whole lot about, and maybe they're going to be a little bit better than you expected. I think that's been the case with the Crew. I think that they seem to be very well coached, very well organized. They seem to like to keep possession and, keep things close whenever possible. And it's really interesting to see how the attitudes of people change over time, or maybe don't change over time in certain cases. They're an interesting team, and I'm not necessarily looking forward to playing them because they are obviously a team to worry about. They're not the same team that the Sounders beat 4-0 last year, but it'll be interesting to see. And I think you'll learn a lot about the Sounders. I think this will be definitely their biggest challenge since the Zach Iwani and O'Brien White injuries. But we'll also learn something about the Crew, which hopefully will be fun.
Yeah, I think you're right. My assessment of the Crew is essentially a team that likes to keep possession. They're not necessarily a team that likes to attack with that possession, but they like to keep possession, and I think they've been winning the possession battles for the most part. They've been completing a relatively high percentage of their passes. They don't take a lot of shots. They don't score a lot of goals at all. I think they've only scored 5 run-of-play goals this year, which is probably only better. I would imagine it's only better than the Union.
Yeah.
And but their defense is good. Last week I was writing about them, and it's funny because their defense has 3 new players on it. and or three new regular starters, and then Rich Balchon, I think that's how you say his name, he actually had to sit out last week. He's a rookie. He's been starting for them at left back, and he had to sit out last week, and a guy named Josh Gardner played for him. And Josh Gardner had not started an MLS game since 2006, and I don't know how many guys are in the league that can go 5 years between starts.
I can't imagine it's many.
No, and it's not. And this is not. You know, I would think, you know, Kenny Cooper went 2 or 3 years between. I don't know. I guess probably 2 years between starts, but that was because he was playing in Germany. Right. Josh Gardner was not playing in Germany. I want to say Josh Gardner was probably playing in Division 2, or heck, he may have been in Division 3. But then, you know, he ends up coming up with the play of the game. He basically stopped a point-blank shot by making a sliding save right at the far goalpost on what looked to be a guaranteed equalizing goal from Vancouver. And, you know, it's like those are the kind of plays that they seem to be getting. This is not a team that is going to blow you away by any stretch of the imagination. You know, Robbie Rogers is he actually will do some okay stuff with the ball, but he's definitely not a finisher. If you've watched him play at all, of course now he's going to score 3 goals against the Sounders.
Of course.
But you know, it's like they don't really have Emilio Renteria, I guess, is probably their best goal scorer, but he's hardly able to get on the field for him because he's just not a very complete player. Andres Mendoza is a designated player for them, but he's not really a classic designated player. He's more of, you know, one of these guys who, you know, they actually brought him in last year not as a designated player, but for some reason his transfer fee kicked in this year, and so now he is a designated player, but he's been hurt. You know, Dilly Duca has been playing more for him. He was a number one pick, I want to say, in the 2009 draft, maybe. Mm-hmm. But you know, they have some interesting players. You know, it seems like to me they're a team that is like Eddie Gavin is that team. And for some reason, I always think of Eddie Gavin as the Crew, and it's like a really unattractive player who somehow is always in Bob Bradley's, U.S. national team pool.
Right. And
he just does enough to kind of be around. The thing is, do you realize that he made his MLS debut at 16?
That's pretty insane.
Yeah.
Usually players that make their MLS debut at 16 are not still playing in MLS when they're 24.
Well, and
so let's put it that way.
Yeah, and they or else they're like, I mean, the thing is, I have to imagine at one point he was probably a highly skilled player, and he's not a bad player. Obviously, he still gets a fair amount of looks at the U.S. national team. I mean, but he's like the definition of like a solid MLS player. There's nothing spectacular about his game at all.
I think that Eddie Gavin is the most American midfielder in MLS playing right now. I mean, American midfielders
are... That sounds right, yeah.
They're of a very specific ilk, generally. Brad Evans is kind of indicative of that. I'd say that Michael Bradley is kind of the pinnacle of that, where, you know, they just... They're just very American. That's not at all a slam or anything like that. It's just... It's a style of play, just like there's, you know, the English forward and the Spanish... Spanish attacking mid or what have you. It's just a very specific style of play that they have, and I think that Eddie Gavin just completely embodies that.
Yeah, so we're going to have to... It'll be interesting. I do think that this game is going to probably tell us more about the Sounders than... You know, I think that this game... I hate to put too much pressure on one game or put too much emphasis on one game in terms of what we get out of it, but I do think that there's... You know, if there's one game that's going to tell us a lot about how this season's going to go, you know, from here on out, and it really does look like O'Brien White and Steve Zakuani are definitely out for anything resembling the foreseeable future. But, I mean, just from what I know of the O'Brien White situation, I don't really expect him to be back anytime soon. I mean, it seems like he could definitely be out for a few months, if not for the whole season. So, I think that... For the most part, this is the team that we're going to have until, you know, July or so. And I think that a game on the road against the Columbus Crew is probably a good benchmark in terms of telling us how good this team really is.
I think so. I mean, this was the game last year that I think kind of solidified the fact that the Sounders were – that what we saw at the beginning of the year was an anomaly. You know, that this was what the team was really going to look like, and of course it was Blaise Coupeau's coming out party. And so, you know, I think this has the potential to be the same sort of thing, where, you know, it kind of looked like the season might take a turn for the worst, and it's too early to tell at this point. It'll probably be too early to tell after DC United, but, you know, if Seattle can go in and beat a tough crew team, or even, you know, draw in sort of an impressive fashion, then I think that says a lot. And I think that, you know, it's a lot easier for the Sounders to impress at home. I want to see them do the same thing on the road.
So with that in mind, what do you think is a reasonable expectation is for? I mean, would you be happy with 2 points if the Sounders come away with 2 points on this road trip? Is that something that you say, I'm perfectly happy with it? 3 points, 4 points. I mean, what do you kind of say is the target for this?
My inclination is to say that no, I wouldn't be happy with 2 points. Obviously that can change depending on the way things go, and you know, you can. Soccer is just sort of the nature where you can play very well and only get a point. That's just kind of the way it goes. But, you know, I feel like the Sounders should beat DC in DC. That's, you know, it's not an easy place to play, and DC is not in any way, shape, or form a complete and total scrub of a team, but they're not that good either. And I think that they're of the caliber that Seattle should outperform and beat. Columbus, you know, I'm not entirely sure, as we've kind of talked about. You know, I don't think we really have a great handle on them. So I think that, you know, if the Sounders can win one of these two games, I'd be content. I think if they can take 4 points, I'll be very happy. I don't expect them to take 6 points. I don't think that's reasonable. If they do, I'll be thrilled. If they take 6 points, I am back on the Sounders for Supporters Shield train, at least for another 6 days or so.
Yeah, I would say that I don't know that there's ever a road trip in MLS that you can go on and say, well, I want. I mean, you can always say you want 6 points, but I don't think it's ever reasonable to say you expect 6 points. And just to kind of illustrate that point, last week there were 9 games, I believe, on the MLS schedule, and home teams went 8-0-1.
Yeah.
And I'm using the American version of that, so
right,
8 wins and a tie.
Yeah, I think that just the parity is enough in this league that home field advantage erases it in most cases, especially going all the way to DC. That's a long trip.
It is a long trip, and I guess they're going to be gone. This is and I guess it makes sense. They flew out this morning, I believe, or they may have flown out last night. I think, well, whatever. They're already in D.C. right now.
So Freddie, I think, tweeted that the plane had landed a couple hours ago. So oh,
yeah.
Yesterday this morning.
Let him sleep, right?
I saw that. That was adorable.
Did you see how he spelled his name, too?
I did.
That was an interesting... he spelled it FLAKOFERNANDES. Now, maybe autocorrect got him or something, but...
It could be. It could be. The flock, though, I'm...
In English and Spanish is the same, though.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very weird. It's very weird, but whatever. Freddie can spell however he wants. I don't care.
Sure can.
Put a random Q in every word. I don't...
Yeah, fine. Exactly. So, anyway, I think we've kind of set our piece. I don't know. Do we have anything else we need to talk to our readers? We don't have readers here. We have listeners.
We have listeners. It's true. But I would imagine they're readers, too, to some extent.
Speaking of which, do we have any updates on that we can pass along to our listeners / readers about getting this on RSS or iTunes or any of that stuff?
You know, nothing specific, but I think that we have all of the kinks ironed out as much as they're going to be ironed out, and it's going to happen very soon.
Hopefully, we'd love to hear your feedback. I think at some point we're going to actually create a Twitter feed for Nos Audiatis specific. We'll probably, you know, have an iTunes channel or whatever there. I guess that's a YouTube channel. I think I'm mixing things. But we'll get to all the appropriate media, and we'll make getting a hold of us a little easier than it's been so far. But hopefully you've enjoyed the growing pains that we've been going through, and we'll be able to bring you lots more fun Nos Audientes-ness.
Absolutely.
All right. So just so we're clear, this is our only podcast for the week, and we'll be back next week.
Indeed.
Bye-bye.
See ya.